So this is Pet Phelan from Poach. I'm here with midwife Kate Russell. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Pet. How are you?
Good.
Thanks for having me.
No, that's all right.
Yeah, so a bit about me. I am a midwife by trade. I am from the Northern Territory, Arrandah Larrakia are my family connections. I am currently living in beautiful Bendigo, so Jarjarwarung country. Mm-hmm. Spent 22 years in Melbourne, in Wurundjeri, on Wurundjeri land.
So how did you get interested in your particular field of midwifery, and what was your pathway to get there?
I was lucky enough growing up in Alice Springs to be exposed to women's business out on community, and grandma or auntie's law, being exposed to the grandmas and the aunties, and finding out about the traditional birthing practices and just seeing it. And you know, just I was just really attracted to it as a model, but like as a non-medical model, but also as a just the way the women would come together and that sense of family and community. Involved in that when I was little, and then when I was 19, I was invited to be one of the birth attendants at my best friend, my brother from another mother's birth of his second daughter, and she was a home birth. And she was born in water in a pool. Their independent midwife was absolutely amazing. She was just this strong, just said what she thought, screw the patriarchy, you know, just amazing, amazing woman and so strong. And I was just like, wow, she's amazing. And then to be at the birth and see the way she modeled herself, I thought, wow, that's kind of like me, you know, like I'm pretty out there, but then I do have this quiet side, this quiet energy. And I notice now in reflection, it usually comes out when I'm working with a couple, particularly in a birthing environment. I'm quite good at reading a room and getting a feel for what's going on, and definitely tapping into that intuition. So yeah, so being involved in Celeste's birth was definitely huge for me. Then I went a different path and I did a degree in musical theatre and came to Melbourne seeking fame and fortune, worked lots of crappy call centre hospo jobs so I could go for auditions and whatnot. Got to 27, I realised that, you know, I wasn't getting any younger, wasn't getting any work. And so I had to really think about what were the other things I was interested in besides theatre and singing and dancing and acting and whatnot. And the only thing that I could think of at the time that I read about or that I would watch TV show about, this is obviously very early on in the internet dial-up phase of life, was midwifery and the empowerment of women and the empowerment of families. It appealed to that feminist side of me, but also it appealed to the medical side. I've always been interested in medicine, and my mum was a paramedic, so I got not a lot of influence from her, but you know, I used to test her on all the bones in the body, and you know, she used to wrap me up with bandages and practice on me and stuff. So yeah, so I'd always kind of had an interest in that. Yeah, so I went back as a mature age student and studied my Bachelor of Midwifery in Melbourne and have been working ever since.
So what values or what core values have underpinned your work as a midwife?
My core value in regards to the work that we did with Poach in regards to finding what our key morals and values were. Integrity was absolutely my first, you know, once I whittled it down, that was the thing that was most important to me. And then in recent months, I've also realized that reflection for myself, but also for the people around me, for people to be able to reflect on their behaviour or their treatment of a patient, whether it be in a in a philosophical sense or whether it be in a practical sense, why do you do the things that you do? And is, you know, by doing the things that I do I have integrity in what I'm doing? And I know that I do. I could not work for an organization that doesn't have integrity. And I think advocacy is probably the other one for me in regards to midwifery, because I do buck the trend a little bit, I think, in regards to mid, where I'm not, you get some nurses and midwives who basically don't question why something is being done to a family, and it's usually done to a family, not with a family. So I will ask the hard questions and say, well, why are we doing that, or why are we intervening there, you know? And if you're acting with integrity, you should be able to tell me why you're doing what you're doing. Mm-hmm. With this family, to this family. And if you can't, and you, for example, find that a bit intimidating, or you get aggravated or whatever, then I think, particularly in the medical system, then you need to perhaps reflect on your behaviour and your reasoning behind it. And that's my role as a midwife, to me, is advocate for the family and to be the doorkeeper to make sure that they're kept safe and their needs are met on a holistic level, whoever they are, whatever circumstance they're in. Like, I've worked in private obstetric hospitals, I've worked in public tertiary hospitals, I've worked in home birth, you know, I've observed and been a part of traditional birthing. So I think advocacy for everybody, families, advocacy for other nurses and midwives, particularly when you see a lot of bullying and lateral violence or horizontal violence, is advocacy, reflection, and integrity are probably my key morals, I would say.
What have you learnt about influence, impact, and leadership from the work that you do?
In regards to the influences around and the impact that leadership has, I think I've been able to learn a lot from having bad managers or leaders. So then when the good ones come along, I can see it, and I can see the people who have a shared sense of the same things that I have in regards to advocacy and equity and equality, and they're reflective, and you're able to have a back and forth. Having poor leadership will impact everybody badly. If you have someone who is not reflective or is not willing to advocate for whomever they should be advocating for as a leader, then you'll have poor outcomes. What I've learned is that if I don't follow my integrity and advocate for staff or for community or for families, having kids or any part of my life, really, if I don't advocate and use my influence for good, then it makes me feel really guilty. I feel really guilty. I feel really upset with myself. I beat myself up about it. So I think a good leader sees potential in people, is a positive influence, which then rolls on to making positive impacts.
What does Indigenous leadership mean to you, and how is it different from Western models of leadership?
I don't know what it means to me, to be completely honest. I've had some really good, amazing Indigenous leaders, or I've seen a number of amazing people who I feel are Indigenous leaders. I think it's people who make change, however they make change. Thinking of two particular men in community who I feel are amazing leaders. One is very outspoken and gets his point across that way. The other one is very quiet, very considered and in what he says, but they're both extraordinarily charismatic as well. So I don't know. Indigenous leadership is also, to me, Aboriginal people in positions of decision making, where they are making good decisions for community that have been asked for by community, that they're working in collaboration with community and asking hard questions whether it be of community or non-Aboriginal community, about moving forward. They're moving forward all the time. They're making strides, even if they're just little ones, to aid in empowering Indigenous people.
So what do non-Indigenous health professionals, colleagues and friends have to learn about the way they do things from Indigenous models of leadership?
They have to understand that we need to be treated differently. And it's not saying we need to be treated differently because we're so special and we should have things that other people don't have, but Aboriginality and First Nations issues are not one size fits all. I think, you know, institutionalized racism and unconscious bias is still a huge problem. I was doing a lot of cultural competency training. What I found over and over again is that people just did not even have a basic understanding of Aboriginal history and the fact that there are still massive issues and inequalities today. So I think, you know, yeah, there needs to be just, look, I'm a big fan of a treaty. I think that'll be great. How we get it, I don't know. Also, that just because one Aboriginal person comes in to the hospital doesn't mean that, so the Aboriginal nurse, for example, that's working, it may be nice if she gets to work with the Aboriginal family or whatever. Ideally, we would like everyone culturally competent or proficient enough that anyone could work with that client without doing further damage.
Absolutely. If that makes sense. And I think you've obviously got your Aboriginal hospital liaisons that are supposed to fill that role of engaging with the family, and all health professionals, whether it's doctors, nurses, midwives, or allied health professionals, even administration staff, everybody needs to have, as you said, a proficiency of cultural safety and at the basic level, cultural competence to be able to work with anybody who walks through that door.
Absolutely. And I think also the understanding, because, you know, I know for other marginalised groups that they do have, like there's the Farat workers, which are the African women who work with the other African women. And, you know, there's lots of great little pockets for other vulnerable people. But we're often lumped into kind of Aboriginal and, you know, English as a second language, you know, like
diversity.
Culturally and linguistically diverse group. Yes, we're all vulnerable groups. But what needs to be remembered is that no matter what anyone says, this is Aboriginal land that was stolen. We are still suffering from inequities, especially in regards to health. So that's why we need to be treated differently.
For a day or for a year or for however long you required, if you were in charge of your industry and your profession, what would be the changes that you would make to improve the health and well-being of Indigenous people, but also the health and well-being of all people?
Yeah, I would have true and genuine connections, and it has to come from the top down, because if you're not supported by the director of nursing, the director of the hospital, the hospital board, you're not going to get anywhere. So it has to come from the very top. So I would only employ people who knew what they were talking about and understood why we need to be treated differently. So I was in a supportive environment where I knew that I could put, for example, genuine, true, heartfelt cultural competency into the induction program for every single staff member, not just the nursing staff, the frontline staff, the ward clerks, because we know that they can often make or break a patient's admission into hospital. There can often be casual bias or unrecognized racism, you know, that which is still absolutely prevalent in our society, and it's not pulled up. And when you're an Aboriginal person in a hospital setting, there's so much trauma related to our relationships with hospitals, but that you're also sick. When you're sick, you're the most vulnerable that you're ever going to be. You know, you need to be supported in that environment. I would get a board, a governing body where there was no nepotism. Everyone had the greatest utilitarian approach. I would have it with all different ethnicities. I think it's really important that you have non-Aboriginal people who know what they're talking about, and I know quite a few of them. They are good. They are advocating for us, and they're the ones who are being asked questions on the front lines that people are perhaps afraid to ask us as Aboriginal people because they don't want to upset us. So I would see mandatory cultural competency come in for every single staff member, whether you worked in the canteen or you were the consultant of everything. And every year you would have to do a refresher on that. If you did not pass by a certain amount, then you would have to redo it. There would be some sort of another step then that you would have to go to. Anyone who saw any racism or suspected any racism would be encouraged to name it and shame it, whether it be with the manager or the exec, and it would actually be chased up. It would actually be something that there was a discussion around what was said, what was done. Do you understand why that's not appropriate, or there's been a miscommunication? And then responding to that on a heart and an empathetic level. I don't think we do ourselves any justice by hitting people around the head with their own ignorance. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, you're going to always get 10% of people that don't care, that are just, you're not going to be able to change their minds. You're going to get another 10% of people that you may be able to change their minds, and 80% of people who just go along with it and go, oh, yeah, cool. So they may or may not have an idea. But if we can start working that way, that would be amazing. The Aotearoa Māori community have got a really good basis in regards to health and First Nations health and hospitals and training up Indigenous staff. I would look at putting different models of nursing and midwifery in place for Aboriginal students to study, because at the moment the way I feel is that the way you become a nurse or a midwife or a doctor is very anglicised. It's mm-hmm. still a very white way of learning. I think that the way we set up our assessments could be very different. I think a practical-based program for Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander nurses, midwives, doctors, where you actually are working on the ward with an Aboriginal mentor who is your preceptor, who is keeping you safe from that institutionalised racism, which is there, but is also a midwife or a nurse or a specialist in whichever field you're working in. So you have someone there with you who's always got your back. You've got access to the Aboriginal Hospital Liaison Officer so that they can support you when you need to debrief. Training more and employing more Aboriginal Liaison Officers, nurses, midwives, doctors, but doing it in a different way that works for us, because the way everything's set up at the moment is set for upper middle class, tertiary educated, come from a family of tertiary educated males, heterocentric. You know, we need to make a space that is specifically for us and caters for our needs. But none of that's going to happen unless we have mainstream support from the top trickling down.
What is it that you love most about your profession?
My favourite thing is being able to make a difference in one family's life, in one shift. Whatever, you know, the system is very broken, and sometimes it can get you down, and sometimes you only see the negatives of it. But I love being a midwife so much, and educating while I'm working with a family, because that's just who I am and what I do. Because in my opinion, you need knowledge to make decisions, appropriate decisions. So, you know, I'll just start teaching a family, like, for example, if you've got a woman who's having issues around breastfeeding, for me to be able to sit with that family and talk through what's happening, why it's happening, how the partner can support, how the family members can support the feeding, how we can support mum, how we could support dad or partner, and this is what we need to do. working in collaboration, working with that family, because you don't know what you don't know. And then at the end of your shift, if you can walk out and that baby's on the boob and feeding beautifully and mum's so happy, or the family's happy, or you've got a plan in place and give them the information to make an informed decision or a plan so that they know which way they can go, I just feel if empowering, that's what it is. If I can empower a family to make their own decisions once they've got some evidence-based research that will fit their family, suit their family needs, and I walk out of there and I have one win with one patient, then that's what makes me love what I do. So I just keep out of all the politics and the BS, and I just sit in my room with my patients and including everyone and empowering them to feel like they've got the knowledge to decide what they want to do when they're at their most vulnerable makes me really happy.
What is it that you dislike the most about your profession?
The medicalization of women and women's health and birth, and taking away people's opportunity to be empowered or to have choices, to make choices.
Adding on top of that, what do you dislike most about your profession as an Aboriginal woman?
Institutionalized racism.
Yeah.
And unconscious bias. Yeah, it's there. That's it. You know, like those are the things that as an Aboriginal person you walk away with. You know, at the end of the day, if you have a really adverse outcome, you know, say a baby dies, that's awful. Everyone walks away having a shitty day after that. But when you go to work, you have your day's fine. You're having a good day. You make a difference for a family. And then like, for example, when I was at work a couple of weeks ago, and, you know, I know I'm going to encounter it. The couple I was working with, who were a really nice couple, you know, one was a school teacher, he was a farmer, just such nice people. And then they started talking about Aboriginals. And she said to him, you don't know what you can say around people, you know. And he said, oh, yeah, no, but these guys are all right. I just thought, wow, I could fight this fight or I can just be quiet because I'm new at this hospital. And they were really nice people. And they just have loads of unconscious bias. I was so shocked and upset because they didn't get it.
If it was up to you in that professional environment and you weren't fearful of being pulled up on it, losing your job, you said you're brand new at the hospital, so obviously there's fears there around that sort of thing.
Yeah.
What would you have liked to have said to them?
God, I can't, honestly, Pet, I can't even imagine a world where I could do that, where would I even start, you know, because it's such a, there's just so many layers to it because they're in labor, they're having, you know, we're chatting, they're going to have a baby. I'm kind of focusing on that. At what point do I put that black hat on? Do you know what I mean? Like it is that real, we have different hats that we wear and it's hard to wear both hats at the same time. I honestly don't know. I would love to give them the big spiel on unconscious bias, but, you know, maybe a time machine would be great to go back in time. And she was a teacher as well. That's what kind of made me go, oh, that's what the comment was. It was about, I was asking her about her job, and she teaches at a school somewhere more rural than here. And she said, oh, yeah, but it's a pretty good school. You know, we don't have a high number of Aboriginal students or DHS involvement. And I was like, wow, you know, like mind blown. I was, and that's when she told him off or he told her off, I can't remember, but I was really shocked that that was the measurement of what a good school was. I would, in a perfect world, go back to her teaching degree and have her have cultural safety training, because what's she teaching to her students in that unconscious space and then to this baby that she birthed?
Yeah. these stories are really important, and this is why I want to have these discussions with people, because yes, everyone has gone through the education system and different pathways to get into whatever profession they've got into. Once you're in the health professions as an Indigenous person, you're fighting against a system that really wasn't made for you.
No.
And, you know, the system might say, well, we've made leeway for you, but it's a system that is inherently very damaging, because it doesn't take into account culture as a priority. And that's for staff and that's for consumers, like health consumers. So it's really important for me to have these stories and get these narratives, because I think they're very powerful, not just for Indigenous people wanting to go into health professions to be aware of the things that they might come up against, but also for professionals that are non-Indigenous to actually think about things differently. And, you know, stories are inherently powerful. So hearing stories and hearing many people's stories are very similar things, because what you're saying is exactly what other people I've interviewed have said around either the education system or the nursing system or the medical system. Over and over again, listening to that, it starts to sink in for people who maybe aren't aware of it or choose to ignore it when they are aware of it.
We need to stop being othered and stop being an afterthought and being tacked on to something. And things need to be tailored specifically in the education system, because that's where we all start. And I think that's why I am so passionate about health information and education around midwifery, which is my passion, and Indigenous midwifery and rights for women around their bodies. This was only a couple of weeks ago that this happened. So as an Aboriginal midwife, I was there and I had a great day. I had a beautiful birth. It was awesome. But I still walked out of there feeling shitty and feeling that gut-wrenching, churning thing in my solar plexus that was like, what could I have done? Should I have said something? Yeah, you probably should have. Why didn't you say something? Because you knew and you're fearful. Does that make me a race traitor? Does that make me a sellout? What would such and such have done? I should stand up and not work at that hospital again. Or you can have a great day, but it can still be a crappy day.
Yeah. Who are the leaders that you look up to, either Indigenous or non-Indigenous, and what have they taught you?
The two that come to mind would be Gary Foley. He taught me that I wasn't an angry black. I wasn't a mouthy know-it-all whatever, that I am a social dissident, that I call out injustice when I see it, and that I am on the right side of the Lord, for example. And it just the encouragement that he and the belief that he has in me as a woman, as a healthcare professional, as an Aboriginal academic, because I had, not so much now, it's getting better, such bad imposter syndrome. And then when someone of Foley's character believed in me and thought I was good and good enough to go to Poche, and then having you guys believe in me as well, I was like, wow. Foley taught me that I am worthwhile and that my opinion matters and I have every right to stand up for myself. And the other would be Dennis, Professor McDermott, who passed away recently. And Dennis did exactly the same thing for me, except in a completely different way. He was considered and you know, when he said something, he didn't just say it for the sake of saying it. You know, I learned so much from him in regards to how you capture an audience. So, yeah, so both of those two men are definitely amazing influences for believing in me, both offering me lots of encouragement and opening up experiences for me.
For any Indigenous person looking to commit to a career in midwifery, what advice or guidance would you give them?
I would say to them, when you're at uni, get in touch with the Indigenous Academic Unit first day, as soon as you get there. Access everything that you can possibly access, whether it be tutoring, whether it be scholarships, whatever you need, get in touch with them, or, you know, accommodation. Ask them everything that they have on offer. Don't be afraid to go to them if you need to debrief, if you need to call out an academic on racism. Know that they will have your back 110%. When you go on placement, make friends, find the Aboriginal Hospital Liaison Officer, ASAP, first day. If you know any Aboriginal nurses or midwives who are working at the facility that you're at, get in touch with them. Find a nursing or midwifery mentor through whatever networks you have. Be who you are.
What does allyship mean to you?
It is working in collaboration, working in non-hierarchical way. It's about people coming together and bringing something to the table that is a thought, is an idea, is something that we can look at and make something from, I guess. I mean, it's about working in collaboration. And even if you have different ideas on things, it's about seeing the other group's point of view and being able to come to a middle ground, I guess.
Yep. What skill sets, knowledges, and behaviours do you believe make an excellent ally?
An excellent ally is someone who knows exactly where you're coming from, even if they haven't had that lived experience themselves. They've got to believe in you. They've got to back you up. They need to have empathy for the experiences.
As an Aboriginal woman, what advice or guidance would you give allies so they may be responsible, activated, and effective?
To me, the most important thing is to ask questions and not presume knowledge. I've found recently, particularly in academia at the moment, wearing one of my other hats, there are some very wonderful women who see themselves as allies. They're very, you know, liberal leaning, very open. However, they still have white privilege and still think they're right about certain things. And they will go ahead and do something or put forward an Aboriginal case study for a nursing prac. And then they'll want Aboriginal people to be the actors. And when I work with other wonderful Aboriginal academics, our automatic response is, no, you can't do that. They're shocked and they're embarrassed because they don't know what they don't know. The triggering of trauma, you know, all that kind, all the stuff that we know, they need to ask the question. And anything that comes up about Aboriginal people, they should say, hey, whomever is their go-to person, what do you think about this? Do you think this is appropriate? And having more than one Aboriginal person to talk to, I think, is a really good idea, because what I feel is appropriate may be different to what someone else feels is appropriate. You need to have more of a quorum that your ally, if they're non-Indigenous, can go to and ask questions. Just don't assume knowledge.
What do you see are the major keys to empowering Indigenous people both locally and internationally?
Culturally competent non-Indigenous people around them, for us all to be on the same page, and for Indigenous people to have strong leaders of all different personality types and from all different groups and all different experiences that are strong and powerful and prepared to make change, even if it ruffles feathers, to have the whole non-Indigenous world work with us.
What is your unique vision for Indigenous people in Australia and around the world?
I don't know if it's a unique vision per se, but I would really like to see all Indigenous people around the world have the same health standard as non-Indigenous people. So I would like to see the school system be completely revamped for Indigenous people, and maybe make non-Indigenous people do it our way for a little bit or forever. Or, yeah, there you go. No, There we go. Got it. Light bulb. That's my unique view, is that non-Indigenous people around the world have to do things our way, the end.
There's not much more I can say. That is like the best final point ever.
Yay, thanks. Yeah, no, that's it. That is exactly what I want.
Kate, thank you so much for the interview.
My pleasure, darling.
Appreciate you spending time with me, having a conversation and sharing all your wonderful knowledge and stories.
Thank you, darling. It's lovely to see you and touch base with you.